The Guardian.
Welcome to Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. In this week's podcast, Tartan TV, we go north of the border to look at plans for a new digital network for Scotland.
This will happen. I'm absolutely convinced this will happen. It's an idea whose time has come. It has a very high level of public support here.
Media Talk makes your eyes water with the satirical news website The Onion. And our own Anna Pickard is in the US to tell us what the Americans will be sending to our screens later this year. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, it's not been a particularly good week in the newspaper world, to be quite honest, with cost-cutting all over the place. And here at The Guardian, we're not immune. So we say a frugal hello to Director of Digital Content, Emily Bell. Have you tightened your belt, Emily?
I have, and I've had to let it out again because I'm sitting near the biscuits.
Welcome also to the press correspondent of MediaGuardian.co.uk, Stephen Brook. Are you feeling the pinch, Stephen?
Well, actually, I've just got a little mini temporary job promotion. So you can now refer to me as acting editor.
You're acting editor.
MediaGuardian.co.uk.
Because with the
budget, which I intend to bust over the coming month.
What have you done with Jason Deans?
He's on what I think is referred to as a sabbatical.
Oh, I see. What he said.
He really is on a sabbatical. Stephen's made it sound like he's had him off or sacked.
I'm a force to be reckoned with. Nothing will stand in my way.
Jason Deans is obviously off writing his first novel. Now, before we get going, can I make a public service announcement? Well, it's actually related to this subject of the economics of media. So that we can continue to bring you this excellent podcast free of charge, we're going to start taking, whisper it, advertising for a trial period. The ads will be limited to one 30-second spot per podcast, which you'll hear right at the start of the show, and the trial starts next week. Now, you know that we are always interested in your feedback on anything that we do. We're not interested in your opinions on this. Comments are closed on this entry. Now, let's start the podcast this week with those tales of woe in the newspaper world. A very depressing set of ABC circulation figures, with pretty much every newspaper taking a hit. Then it was announced that 80 jobs are to go at the Express Group. Trinity Mirror is closing 7 local papers, and News International has reversed a plan to move to big new headquarters in London. Now, Stephen Brook, you're the press correspondent, so you know all about this. It's all sounding rather depressing, yet, you know, part 987. Let's start with the Express. I mean, I didn't even know there were 80 jobs to cut at the
Express.
It's
a shocker, isn't it?
Well, that's the news line from that story.
In effect, there aren't, and not all the jobs are full-time staff. It's going to be 36 staff sub-editors from the Daily and Sunday Express in London are going to be gone by the end of the year. That's out of 62 subs employed by both papers. Now, there are also 33 long-term regular casual sub-editors who work sort of between 4 and 5 shifts a week, plus 17 other casuals.
And interestingly, the Telegraph has stopped using casuals this week as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's happening in two stages. So all casual reporters have gone, and by mid-October, all casual subs would have gone, and the Telegraph is creating 40 new staff positions and totally changing the rotas to accommodate that. So the subs are up in arms because long-standing practices, such as not having to work on Saturdays, are going to be swept away.
So does this mean at the Express that it's, in effect, the end for the sub-editing function?
Well, there will still be some subs there, but the Express have got this new editorial system called Woodwing. Right. And the union fears that it's going to mean that reporters input directly their stories onto a page. And then they'll get a very brief, cursory glance over before it actually hits the presses.
Isn't that what's happened at the Express for years anyway? But what's the context of all of this, Emily? Because it's not just in the UK that this is happening.
No, we know that there is a global economic downturn because we hear a great deal about it. We know that in America there has been systemic decline in newspaper sales, both regionally and nationally, for a couple of years. I think that people feel worried here that we're probably about sort of 6 to 9 months behind the States. And if you looked at in July, for instance, New York Times, which is a very good sort of bellwether of the top end of the market, said that ad revenues across the board were down by 11%. Now, that's offset against things like About.com, which is its web arm growing, and growth in digital revenues. And actually, their CEO, Janet Robinson, at the time said this is about the economy, but it's also about widespread secular problems throughout the whole of the print industry.
So this is going to hit publicly quoted companies particularly hard, isn't it?
Well, it is, because I think that what news organisations now have to decide is how much of this is cyclical and how much of it is systemic. Mm. If you believe that we were going to crawl out of the recession in 18 months' time and we were going to see untrammelled levels of growth for the next 10 years, which is sort of rather what happened in the mid-90s to 2006, 2007, you would have every confidence in investing in your product. The problem is that readership is just on the way down. And I think that in America, what you've seen is a number of titles where the circulation declines have suddenly rapidly increased. So you've gone from 3 to 4% down year on year to 10 to 12% down on year on year. And there's a feeling, I think, that that's something which will be replicated in this market. And what you can see at the moment is that with the national papers, we've seen price rises from the Independent, which is going to £1, and Stephen will know more about this than I do. But
well, the Telegraph's already gone up to 90p.
Mm. And suddenly sort of people are saying this is no longer about getting people to buy as many papers as we can, hence the sort of Rupert Murdoch cutting prices in 1991.
In parallel with that is this sudden push now to subscriptions. So the Independent is offering home delivery within the M25. The Times and the Sunday Times is offering that for free. Plus, they're also copying the Telegraph's much derided system of vouchers, where you pay in advance at a huge discount and then trot off to your local newsagents.
This is about trying to nail down certain revenue. Mm. And that's absolutely the key distinguishing mark of a market which people recognise is in terminal decline.
Because if you have a set subscription list, you know how much money you're going to get.
Exactly. And you're willing to shed a certain amount of what we might call promiscuous readers, seems an odd phrase in conjunction with the Telegraph, in order just to be able to say, we know that our papers will be going into this many homes every day. And even though the price is a fraction of what they might be paying at full price at the newsagents,
we'll be getting that revenue up front and in advance.
Is any of this anything to do with, is the decision, I should say, by News International not to move from Whopping, which they had been planning to do, is that anything to do with all of this?
Well, obviously, it's been taken at a time when the credit crunch is biting. But in some sense, that was going to be advantageous to News because they needed a big new premises to house not just the papers, but under James Murdoch's big desire to have News Corp acting like News Corp in Britain instead of being HarperCollins and 20th Century Fox and Dow Jones and News International at all these separate sites. He wanted one big building. So you would have thought that he could have done that cheaper at this point in time than he could have previously because the bottom is falling out of the London commercial property market. But then also he wants a building or a campus, as they're now going to be calling Whopping, that could house about 3,000 employees.
And there's not that many sites that you could do that on.
Exactly.
So it's campus Whopping rather than fortress Whopping.
Can I just say I'm very much enjoying the idea of MySpace and Dow Jones. you can imagine, can't you? It's like, like the Dow's really like collapsed, this morning. So apologies to Armstrong and Miller. Can't wait to be invited round.
Who told 20th Century Fox that they've got to leave Soho Square?
Oh, yes.
And head to Whopping.
Do you know, I think the person who told them that was James Murdoch, and I think they said, okay.
Now, let's not all
Did
be...
You read, though, what the architect was talking about, Whopping,
no.
This new firm that they've hired. Amanda Levitt, I think her name is, and she had a hand in designing the Bullring at Birmingham, you know, the new Selfridges building that looks like that sort of blobby spaceship.
It's going to look like Selfridges in Birmingham, everybody. Yeah. Brace
anyway,
yourselves.
This was her take on Whopping. I was drawn to the building by its hidden power and integrity.
Been to Whopping?
Clearly not.
The question's got to be asked.
it looks like a big prison camp, frankly.
It doesn't look like one. It operates like one. You actually have to go through Checkpoint Charlie to even get in there.
You do, yeah, this is true. Now, listen, it's not all been doom and gloom in the newspaper industry. There was excitement when the Sun came to Covent Garden this week. You, Stephen, know a bit about this because you were there.
I was there.
What's all this about?
To start at the beginning, Rupert Murdoch had lunch in New York quite a few months ago with Lady Helen Hamlin, who runs a trust and is very tied up with Covent Garden and promoting it. And she came up with the idea that they could get a lot of people into the opera who'd never been before. Right. If they organised a sale of tickets at vastly discounted prices through The Sun. So Rupert Murdoch then got on the blower to Rebecca Wade, the editor, and said, tell me if this is a crazy idea or not.
She said, okay.
I think once the son worked out it was going to be Don Giovanni, which is about a man who shags his way through Europe, and they thought, yes, this is something we can sell to our readers. So basically, top opera price ticket, about 130 quid. They were sold through the Sun for a maximum price of 30 quid. And I think the cheapest was about £7.50, which is what they sell their famous holiday.
£9.50,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And so the first night of the season was full of Sun readers.
And
I don't think it was. I think it was full of Guardian readers who had bought the Sun in order to go to the opera.
Funnily enough, we have some evidence about this.
This isn't your first time at the opera. Are you a regular opera goer?
I most certainly am, yes. We come about two or three times a week if we can.
So how is tonight different to other nights that you've been?
I don't really see much difference. The clientele may be a little bit different. I hear a lot more rustling behind me. But other than that, I think it's fantastic.
Is this your first time at the opera?
No, went a few weeks ago to another opera at Glyndebourne.
So did you come here as part of the Sun offer?
Yes.
And are you usually a Sun reader?
Not really, no.
Why not?
I just don't really read newspapers.
As you hinted, Emily, not all of them, funnily enough, Sun readers.
No, and that person, the rustling, I think was our own arts blogger, Charlotte Higgins. It was Chicky with a massive bag of sweets, because she likes it when people rattle their sweets.
Charlotte Higgins, on her blog on The Guardian, she said it was quite testing, because it's 3.5 hours, and the production was well below par. So, she wasn't very impressed. Stephen Brooke, how is it for you?
Well, I would have given it 5 stars, and right. I'm not a regular opera goer, but I am a regular Sun reader.
So do we approve of the initiative? We should point out.
What's not to like about this?
Nobody's pointed out that just a couple of years ago, the Sun was banging on about the Royal Opera House, about being elitist and...
times change. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, consistency has never been the strong suit at the Sun now, has it? No, I think it's absolutely marvellous. I want to see more of it. I want to see the Daily Star supporting... Well, Glyndebourne is it? Garsington's had to shut. It could get behind that. Could maybe, get Katie Price or somebody to take their top off of the tenors.
Actually,
Whatever happened
to my career as a backbench sub on a downmarket tabloid? Yes.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Still to come on Media Talk, something to make your eyes water. The team behind The Onion's new video service talk to Jemima Kish. And Anna Pickard is in the States looking at a few of the new series that are coming our way, including Sky One's big, bright hope for the autumn season.
What happened on that plane might have been part of something more dangerous than just simple terrorism.
He was part of a classified U.S. Army experimental program in an area called Fringe Science.
They're calling these events a pattern. As if someone out there is experimenting, only the whole world is a lab.
You're telling me my father was Dr. Frankenstein.
How exciting. More on that later. But first, there was a call this week for Scotland to get its own digital television channel. It was the main recommendation in a report by the Scottish Broadcasting Commission. Now, this was set up by the First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, to look at issues facing broadcasting in Scotland, including the controversial idea that the BBC should replace its UK-wide news bulletins with programmes produced in Scotland. Interestingly, the Commission rejected this idea, but did go on to call for this new digital network. Blair Jenkins, a former BBC head of news and current affairs in Scotland, led the report. I spoke to him earlier this week, and I started by asking him why he'd come up with a recommendation for a digital network.
Well, there are three main reasons. The first is that what we need in Scotland is a secure and sustainable source of public service competition for the BBC here. The second thing is all our work, the surveys we've done in Scotland, demonstrates that there's a considerable appetite for a greater volume and range of Scottish material to be available here. And I think the other third compelling reason is this will really help to underpin and transform the creative content industry in Scotland. We think it would provide a very good addition to the economic growth of the creative content sector here.
Why did you not go for the long-standing proposal that the BBC should produce a dedicated national and international news programme in Scotland? This is the so-called Scottish Six debate.
And this is a landmark year for the BBC in this area because the report they commissioned from Professor Anthony King demonstrated unequivocally that the BBC is not delivering a proper and an appropriate news service for viewers in all parts of the UK. So having acknowledged the real difficulties that there are, it's now appropriate that the BBC takes time to reflect on that. They've said they're going to have another look at this next year. They've said they're open-minded about the possibility of structural change, and that's probably the right place to be in at the moment.
How would your proposals be implemented, given that the Scottish Government, which commissioned your report, doesn't have control of broadcasting policy, and you're not suggesting that that should be changed, are you?
What we've said is that there is merit in the UK framework in parts of broadcasting. But there is absolutely no doubt, and this is true across all the political parties and widely across public opinion in Scotland, there does need to be greater accountability, greater scrutiny in Scotland, more influence on broadcasting policy and on broadcasting matters. The interesting thing is the degree of cross-party consensus there's been since our report appeared on Monday. On the main recommendation, which is the Scottish Network, I mean, everyone's welcome to concept. We now need to get some of the detail of that sorted out. But there are important parts of broadcasting which are actually, if you like, in the gift or in the control of the Scottish Parliament, Scottish Government. I mean, economic development of broadcasting, for instance. While, as you're correct in saying that currently the interventions we're talking about, if you like, on the demand side are at the UK level, whether it's through DCMS or through Ofcom, but there's a lot we can do in Scotland to improve the supply side to make sure that the sector is properly geared up to deal with and take advantage of these new opportunities.
Okay, say your wildest dreams are realised, Blair, and a go-ahead is given for a Scottish digital network. Who would pay for it?
I should say right away that this will happen. I'm absolutely convinced this will happen. It's an idea whose time has come. It has a very high level of public support here. Now, as you know, Ofcom are currently looking at the future funding models for public service broadcasting in the UK as a whole, and they've identified, I think from memory, 11 possible sources of future funding, ranging from lottery funding, direct grant and aid from the government, etc., etc. So, lots of potential sources there. And what we've said is, at some point, Ofcom will have finished crunching the numbers and will come out with their recommendations for how the future funding of public service broadcasting in the UK as a whole is to be structured and dealt with. And what we've said is, what absolutely has to be weighed into that is the Scottish Network. The other thing we've drawn attention to is that the Treasury will benefit in the next couple of years from the auction of the cleared spectrum, which is one of the benefits of digital switchover. And that's going to raise many billions of pounds for the UK Treasury. So we don't think funding the proposed Scottish Network should be too much of a problem.
Do you fancy running it?
Well, there will be no shortage of applicants. I think it'd be a fantastic thing to do.
Including B. Jenkins?
I really don't know what I'm going to do next, Matt. I'll give you the honest answer is, because I think the work I'm doing now as chairman of the Broadcasting Commission is very important, I've been very clear that I haven't got into any conversations with anybody about what I'll be doing after this, because I didn't want any suggestion that what I might be doing next would influence what I've done in the... In this role. I haven't done anything about what I'm going to do next. As of the end of this month, the commission will be wound up, and from that point on, I will regard myself as free to consider what might be interesting and important to do next. And I hope there'll be a number of potential options.
But Blair Jenkins not remotely ruling himself out there for the top job at the new digital network, should it happen. But, well, as the only person in this podcast studio remotely connected with Scotland, perhaps I should lead the discussion on this.
My name is Belle. I'm entitled to wear a tartan. Off you go.
What I was going to say was that the interesting thing about this report is that it didn't come up with all the recommendations that Alex Salmond, I think, was hoping for. And in fact, Blair Jenkins specifically said that the debate around the future of broadcasting in Scotland should not be a surrogate for the constitutional debate. And he said that had happened too often, and he rejected this idea of the Scottish Six, which is this thing that's been around for years, explicitly rejected it and came up with this new idea for a digital network for Scotland. And part of the reasoning for it is quite sound, because, as ITV's public service commitments It starts to get rid of its public service commitments, and STV, the ITV franchise holder in Scotland, starts to lose more and more money and slims down and cuts back. There is no competition for the BBC in Scotland, and in the rest of the UK, Channel 4 provides that, but Channel 4 doesn't provide competition in Scotland. So perhaps it's an idea that might have some merit.
I think it's really very important, this, and I think it's interesting where it might lead, because obviously, as you say, Channel 4 have S4C, which is the Welsh service, but of course that's distinguished by language. It's actually about cultural delivery.
Yeah.
This is not a Gaelic channel.
No,
this is a Scottish channel.
And in fact, the BBC has just set up a Gaelic channel. So that debate's been parked.
So what you're actually talking about here is regional broadcasting that addresses local issues. And if Scotland should have one of those, what about Cornwall or East Anglia or the South? And I think that there's going to be a lot of tension around the BBC. The debate about sort of what happens to funding and top slicing and Channel 4 and 4IP what are they going to do in the regions? I don't think there is going to be any extra money because we're going into recession. Yeah. Nobody is going to find any extra public money. It will have to come out of the BBC's existing money.
Now, if you've got any views on this or any of the other stories we've been covering this week, head to the blog on Organ Grinder or do write a comment on our Facebook wall. At this point of the podcast, let's take a look at some of the other stories that have been making the headlines on MediaGuardian.co.uk this week.
England fans eventually got to see free highlights of the World Cup qualifying match with Croatia earlier this week after rights holder Setanta broke off talks with terrestrial broadcasters hours before the match when it didn't receive its asking price of £1 million. The Irish Sports Channel decided to broadcast the action unencrypted on its own service after its live coverage the same evening. But in a further twist, it then sold the highlights to ITV1 for broadcast 24 hours later. ITV1's coverage then drew 1.6 million viewers, beating the figures for Setanta's live broadcast. There was more news about football rights, as one analyst suggested that BSkyB may have to pay almost £500 million more than their current contract for the Premier League. The satellite broadcaster may have a potential rival bid from US sports giant ESPN. City Investment Research said BSkyB might have to pay as much as £1.7 billion in next year's auction. And job cuts are expected at BSkyB after it wrapped up its Picnic before it even began. Picnic was Sky's attempt at launching a pay TV service on Freeview. Announced 18 months ago, it was unable to begin because Ofcom had not completed a regulatory investigation of the service. The plans would have seen Sky replace its three Freeview channels with a paid-for service. Instead, it'll now have to let go of 40 contractors, with 28 staff being consulted about redeployment, though redundancies have not been ruled out.
Let's pick up on this Setanta story. Stephen, Setanta, not in the good books of the viewers this week.
They're the new media bad boys, yeah. I think, for depriving England's millions of football fans of the opportunity to watch what turned out to be a glorious match on free-to-air television.
So how did this all happen?
Well, Setanta got the rights for these overseas England games and has been negotiating for weeks with the BBC and ITV about a free-to-air rights package. And the networks say that their asking price was simply far too high. So this all came to a head at 6 p.m. on Wednesday when Setanta put out a release saying that they would show the highlights package on their own sports channel, but unencrypted. But then there are all these problems on what platform or what cable provider you had as to whether you could see it or not, and I don't think the highlights package went out until very late at night anyway.
So it's all a bit of a shambles then.
I saw it. On my otherwise nearly entirely useless Virgin service, I saw it.
Hooray, we can have a go Virgin again.
This isn't actually Setanta's fault, though, is it? It's the FA's fault. I mean, they have to unbundle their rights. Setanta is just a commercial broadcast. It doesn't have any obligation to the nation as a whole. The FA, running the national team, does
too long.
Too bloody greedy. Mind you, if it's all going into Fabio Capello's back pocket, all I can say is fantastic. Well done. You deserve every penny.
Marvellous. Okay, there's more media news at MediaGuardian.co.uk. Now, you may know that we've been holding a series of talks and seminars at The Guardian over the summer on the future of journalism. One of the final sessions in the series was this week, and it involved Will Graham and Julie Smith of the Onion News Network. This is a satirical news website based in the US, and their video service is now watched 5 million times each month. Media Guardian's Jemima Kish spoke to the pair after their talk, and she began by asking Will Graham why they got into video.
It was sort of one of those logical ideas that was always out there, in the sense that people were like, oh, you have this successful website, you should do it to video. And because of the disposition of The Onion, that was always a big reason why perhaps people there didn't want to do it. But like all things at The Onion, I think people got excited about a particular kind of creative idea and direction for it, which was the idea that The Onion News Network is sort of this massive, sinister, more kind of bombastic than Fox News, globe-spanning news organization. And once we got that basic concept, it sort of took off from there. So at first, I was hired, and we just sort of for 6 months explored and experimented and made a bunch of videos that we never released. And once we kind of found the voice of it and the shape of it, we sort of moved to our launch date, and our staff went from just me and a bunch of interns to now I think we're at around 20.
So you want to describe, Julie, perhaps describe the inspiration behind your site. There's been some comparison with Brass Eye in terms of the humour and the spoofing of those kind of big flashy news logos and things.
Fox News was a big inspiration for us, as was MSNBC, and you know, we just tried to be even more, as Will said, bombastic than the real news sources out there.
John McCain is facing new competition on the campaign trail. Jane Carmichael has details in the War for the White House election analysis bunker. Jane?
A new third-party presidential candidate is cutting into John McCain's base of support, attracting voters who feel McCain is not grizzled and ornery enough.
I got a tax plan for you. Uh-huh. Here it goes right now.
If you try and angle news to be more for the American audience, or have you had some thoughts about expanding that to be more international?
We just started a new subgenre of our news coverage that's going to be ONN International. So we're
fantastic,
covering news from around the world, and they'll all be subtitled. They'll all be...
Yeah, it's as if, you know, we kind of have a separate network in every country, so all the Russia clips will be in Russian and Chinese clips will be in Chinese with subtitles and... that kind of thing. So it should be a lot of fun, and it lets us take on a whole new kind of joke. We just did our first clip in Bengali for Bangladesh that I think will come out pretty well. It's about it's sort of an iPhone style piece, like a piece about a BlackBerry. You know, you can stay connected to your work, except it's just a very small sewing machine that sweatshop workers can carry around with them. That was a lot of fun.
Does that satire translate internationally?
I feel like we don't really worry about translating much. We sort of go for what we think is funny. And within our group, there's a fairly broad sensibility. And we assume that the audience will sort of find it.
So which have been the most popular videos you've done?
I think Diebold, which was one of our election pieces, about the voting machines accidentally releasing the presidential election results early, was our biggest hit.
Somewhere in that top three is a video that we did about a kind of porn star using a racist slur during an interview that, you know, sort of a Michael Kramer type of situation that sort of everyone's focusing on the racism and overlooking the sort of sexism of the industry, which was one of our kind of early, really big videos, partly because it was about porn, probably.
Yes, almost certainly, I think we can say. And your production values are really big. I mean, you know, you're not walking around with flip cameras as I do. You know, this is big budget, big sets, proper actors. How do you pay for it all?
Our business model right now is with advertisers. We have ads on each clip. But we've also had to be pretty creative with our production model. So whether it's consolidating shoots, so we have, you know, 8 days where we shoot 22 pieces and really get the most production value as we can, you know, so go for the really nice equipment, but shoot 13-hour days.
And
we're very happy when we hear people say it looks like it's big budget because it's not. And that's what we spend a lot of time trying to kind of make it look like.
Will Graham and Julie Smith from The Onion. Are you Onion fans, either of you, Emily?
Oh, I love The Onion. My 8-year-old's been reading my Onion books. Does mean that I've had to explain what folate means.
Oh, dear. How did you approach that one?
I said it's when somebody sucks somebody else's
willy. You didn't,
yes.
Did you? You explained fellatio to an 8-year-old.
Why wouldn't you?
When a man loves a woman very much. And,
well, it was something like senator fellated by chimp. Okay. So it was, I hope he doesn't repeat it in the playground.
Satiric.
Otherwise, social services will be wrecked. And
okay.
And their videos are brilliant.
Well,
the pants demanding abortion. Sorry, I am such an Onion fan.
Well, I agree. And what I think they've done brilliantly is they've transferred the skill and wit and the power of their parody in text to videos with stunning success.
That's like us.
Completely.
I was just going to say, unlike us, completely failed.
It's completely over the top kind of US cable news network on steroids,
yeah.
And you know, belly laughs all the way.
Okay,
it's the wit and highbrow nature of the Guardian is, I think, amply translated into audio and visual
audio, yes.
Offerings.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's just as well at this point. It's time to bid farewell to our top media couple. Thank you very much, Emily Bell and Stephen Brooke. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Anna Pickard is next.
Could I please ask of you, people of America, to please elect Barack Obama? Please. Some people, I think they're called racists, say America is not ready for a black president. But I know America to be a forward-thinking country, right? Because otherwise, you know, would you have let that retarded cowboy fella be president for 8 years?
Now, that's Russell Brand there, who caused controversy this week as he hosted this year's MTV Video Music Awards. And he joked that one of the band, the Jonas Brothers, who all wear chastity rings, was really a slut, a comment that he quickly had to apologise for. Now, to talk about this and other TV matters in the United States, joining us on the line from San Francisco is Guardian TV writer Anna Pickard, who's just... Well, you've just moved there, haven't you, Anna?
Yes, I have. I've actually only had a TV for 3 days, so you'll have to... I've been catching up with it all online.
Well, you don't need a TV to watch TV these days.
Yeah, it's true.
This Russell Brand business, he's got a particular type of humour, hasn't he? And I wonder whether it didn't quite go down well with the MTV audience.
Yeah, I think some people are calling it kind of, you know, he's either ruined his career forever in the US or he's made it for himself, because it went down very, very badly with some of the more conservative elements of the audience. But I think that's kind of what MTV were hoping for, I think, because they knew what to expect with Russell Brand. And you just don't mess with the Jonas Brothers. They've got this huge Disney-esque fan base.
I was just going to say, you'll have to explain, because I'm not au fait with all the latest boy bands or whatever they are in America. You'll have to explain who they are.
Think about, you know, whoever it was who did Mbop. The kind of like lots of little boys, basically,
yes.
Of around, you know, mid-teenage age. They're marketed towards tweenagers.
Okay, so very High School Musical type thing.
Very High School Musical. And they're owned by Disney, and they have kind of lots of web presence in terms of lots of little films of them doing cute things. And they have a huge and very fierce fan base. I've crossed them myself a couple of times, and it's really ugly.
You know what's going to happen. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be outed and revealed to be snorting cocaine and doing underage sex and all the rest of it.
Just wait until you start getting the hate mail. You will in a couple of days. No, they're lovely boys, lovely.
Right, sure
but
they are, yes.
But you cross them at your peril.
Now, listen. In other American TV news, they've remade Beverly Hills 90210, haven't they?
Well, and they've not remade it. It's not. It's kind of. It's a spin-off of itself.
I see.
So it's a new family. So the original 90210 was this family that moved from Minnesota to Beverly Hills, and now it's a family who moved from Kansas to Beverly Hills, and it's kind of. It's softcore Gossip Girl now, because
right.
It's kind of Gossip Girl for people who can't handle Gossip Girl, I think, or who aren't allowed to stay up late enough to watch Gossip Girl. Or,
well like, quite. And Shannon Doherty is in this one, so it can't
be
that
she's
good.
She's come back. She's come back, but she's being ridiculously nice, as is Jenny Garth, who was also in the original. And they famously had lots of big spats and hated each other and were bitchy as hell to each other for the whole of the first series, which is why Shannon Doherty left. Apparently. But now they've come back and they're being lovely to each other, and it's all very and Shannon Doherty's only come back to direct a High School Musical at the school. So you can really see the demographic
I can see where you are. Now, no doubt there'll be a bidding war amongst the UK broadcasters for that. Now, one of the ones that has already been brought up is Fringe. This is the new drama from J.J. Abrams, who was the executive producer on Lost, I think, wasn't it?
That's right.
And
yeah.
It's meant to be a bit X-Filesy. Is it?
It's kind of a cross between X-Files and CSI, I guess. I mean, it's more kind of science-y than X-Files,
right.
But it does have the kind of supernatural element. But it also has the kind of overriding kind of mythology that Lost has, for example. So it's got a kind of a greater story going on that you're going to find out more and more about as it goes on.
It's been brought up by Sky One. Is it hit or miss?
I say hit. I like to, if you watch the first 5 minutes and you kind of go, oh, there's this guy and he throws up and then his face falls off and it's brilliant and he's on a plane. And if you like that kind of thing, you will like it. And it's got Joshua Jackson, Pacey from Dawson's Creek. And so it's a winner for me.
All right. Excellent. Good. Thank you very much, Anna, for watching so much American television in the short time that you've been there.
Thank you.
We'll check in with you again. Thanks to Anna Pickard. Thanks also to Emily Bell and Stephen Brook for bringing ballast to this week's programme. Media Talk is produced by Scott Cawley. I'm Matt Wells. There'll be more Media Talk soon. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.